For the very last time, ladies and gentlemen, what is Janet Yellen thinking in five words or less, this time from the chair herself?
The U.S. economy is performing well.
Yes, I know that was six words. Work with me here, will you? It's my game. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today the 13th of December. Good as always to have you here, everybody. She is still technically running the economy for another 6 weeks or so, but today was pretty much it for Janet Yellen as the public face of the Federal Reserve. The central bank wrapped up a two-day meeting today. Interest rates are going up, as pretty much everybody had guessed they would, up a quarter of a percentage point to a range of 1.25% to 1.5% for the Fed's short-term rate. The federal funds rate is what that's called. As often happens, though, the questions today at Yellen's press conference were kind of all over the place. A couple of questions on wages, three on Bitcoin. She is not a fan, by the way, and a bunch on what she thinks of the GOP's tax bill. She's not too worried about the downsides, not too impressed by the upsides, and the Fed is just going to stay in its lane. Thank you very much.
So, look, I will just say that it is up to the administration and Congress to decide on appropriate fiscal policy, and our job is to maintain our focus on employment and inflation.
She said, for what is worth, and not for the first time, that she and her colleagues are still a bit perplexed about why inflation in this economy remains so stubbornly low. Jay Powell, assuming he is confirmed, takes over at the beginning of February. We'll tell you about that when it comes. She has one more meeting, by the way, Janet Yellen does, in January. All right, so moving on about the tax bill. House and Senate Republicans have agreed on the basic outlines of the final deal. Details are still being dribbled out, but the statutory corporate rate is going to drop to 21%. It is going to let people deduct some state and local taxes. The individual top tax rate falls as well. At one of those events today that presidents of all parties do when they are trying to sell a particular policy or piece of legislation, the president had this to say about the bill.
This is for the people of middle income. This is for companies that are going to create jobs. This is for very, very special people, the great people of America.
Marketplace's Sabri Benishour asked some great tax expert Americans what they think of the bill.
Is this bill great for the middle class?
I do think this would be a tax cut for the vast majority of Americans.
Nicole Kading is with the Tax Foundation. She says there are goodies for almost everyone.
This plan would grow the U.S. economy and would create jobs along the way.
But who's getting the most out of this bill? Lily Batchelder is a professor at NYU Law.
This bill is a tremendous bill for millionaires and billionaires and for corporations. The middle class gets crumbs.
She says millionaires get a tax cut that's four times larger as a share of income than a family making $30,000 to $40,000. Bill Gale at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center says most of the goodies in the bill, like the cut to the corporate tax rate, pass over the middle class.
Middle class tends not to own a very large share of the corporations in the country. The state tax is not going to help them. Cutting the top rate is not going to help them. This is not a middle class tax cut.
The president and many members of Congress are hoping the bill will be great for the middle class by being great for businesses, which will then create jobs. But models from the Joint Committee on Taxation, or JCT, are not quite as enthusiastic. Again, Lily Batchelder.
The JCT finds a short-term economic boost, but that over time that boost dissipates and possibly reverses because of the deficit impact.
The final verdict on whether this bill is great for the middle class will become more clear in the coming years when the middle class files its tax returns. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Yellen speaks, taxes get cut. It's all upside if you're a stock trader. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Caitlin Esch, the producer on our Wealth and Poverty team, and on the podcast that team does, it's called The Uncertain Hour. Season 2, which we're in the middle of, is all about government regulation and this economy. Anyway, Caitlin spent a bunch of time this past summer in West Virginia and in the corner of Virginia that's down by Kentucky and Tennessee, working on the episode of The Uncertain Hour that came out today. It's the end result of an 8-month investigation of the opioid crisis in this country, of where it came from, and of how more than 2 million Americans got addicted to opioids, often after abusing FDA-approved prescription painkillers. In this case, the blockbuster OxyContin. Caitlin, it's good to have you in the studio.
Nice to be here.
Tell me how you all came to this story.
So, I mean, we're doing a podcast about regulations.
Right.
And so we wanted to look at the regulatory roots of the opioid crisis. And so we ended up looking back at the regulations that brought OxyContin to market more than 20 years ago. OxyContin is a painkiller produced by the company Purdue Pharma.
Yeah.
And it hit the market in 1996. And in certain counties around the country in 97, 98, 99, they were seeing OxyContin being abused in the street.
Right.
So we went to some of those places to see how it unfolded. And then we followed the paperwork back to ultimately a courthouse in a tiny town in the mountains of West Virginia. Mm. And some of the documents I had never seen before. I'd heard or read they existed, but I couldn't find them online, and we couldn't find them anywhere. And we found them here, so we were really excited.
Talk to me then about the documents you found. I mean, you guys filed countless requests to courts. You obviously went to Purdue Pharma. You went to the FDA. You found a trove of documents laying out the history of this regulatory process.
Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of factors at play.
Right.
And, you know, we looked at the package insert, which is also called a label.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a long and wonky document that gives information about clinicals and dosing and side effects of a drug.
Does it actually come inside the package when you get it? I mean, is that tiny little print that we all see and never read?
It's one of the things that comes with a prescription drug.
Yeah.
And you probably don't read it, but it's a really important document. Every sentence is negotiated between the FDA and the drug company, in part because those sentences regulate how a drug can be marketed.
Huh.
Sales reps can't market a drug for anything that's not in the label.
Got it.
We zoomed in on a couple of sentences in that label about abuse and addiction, and then how they were used in the subsequent marketing campaign. One of the sentences about abuse, delayed absorption as provided by OxyContin tablets, is believed to reduce the abuse liability of a drug.
Wait, that's the sentence?
That's a sentence.
Say it again.
Delayed absorption as provided by OxyContin tablets is believed to reduce the abuse liability of a drug.
Maybe it's just me, and I'm no regulatory expert, but believed to reduce does not sound strong, shall we say.
Right. I mean, we know that Purdue didn't do any clinical studies to back it up.
How do we know that?
Depositions that we found, and this has been reported before, but we found depositions with Purdue officials where it really spells out, did you do abuse studies? No. Have you since? No.
Huh.
So there were no abuse studies, and the FDA didn't require it at the time. So there were no abuse studies, but we know that there was market research.
In other words, the company went out and asked people who would use this drug, what do you think of it?
Yeah. So there was a focus group report that was conducted in 1995 as OxyContin was going through the approval process and the FDA was, you know, working on this months-long process of approval.
Which we have seen. You have.
Right. Which we have.
Yeah.
And it was with 40 doctors, surgeons, family practitioners, rheumatologists. Purdue wanted to know how attractive its product was to these doctors, how likely they would be to prescribe it.
Right.
And the focus group report recommended that if Purdue could prove that their drug had a lower abuse liability, meaning people would be less likely to take it to get high
mm-hmm.
rather than treat pain or, you know, sell it on the street, if they could prove that, that would help sell the drug. And we know that this report made the rounds. You can see kind of where the report went office to office.
This idea that the package insert language is negotiated by and between companies and the FDA, in this case, the FDA and Purdue Pharma, is interesting. And it obliges me to ask where the sentence came from. Who wrote it?
Purdue does say that the focus group report had nothing to do
right.
with the
Got
sentence
it.
And that the idea came from the FDA. We have depositions that sort of spell this out. A Purdue official says he thinks that the idea came from the FDA. The FDA medical review officer testifies that he can't remember. But plaintiff's lawyers in another court case pull evidence out of depositions to show that the original idea for some sort of statement like this came from Purdue.
OxyContin's been on the market now for 20-something years. These warnings were in the initial packaging. As you said, it got removed 5.5 years later and then presumably strengthened, yes, as the strength of this drug became and its abusability became known.
Right. So we have some minutes from a meeting from several meetings that took place in 2001 between the FDA and Purdue. And we can see in those minutes that the FDA was very concerned. Purdue acknowledged OxyContin abuse was a problem. And as a result of those meetings, a black box warning was added, which is the strictest warning that a drug can have. And the sentence was removed.
Give me the sentence again.
Delayed absorption, as provided by OxyContin tablets, is believed to reduce the abuse liability of a drug.
I know you've been working on this story for 8 months, but it's kind of amazing you have that thing completely memorized.
Oh, no. And so in 2001, that label changed. But according to the FDA's own numbers, in 2003, 2.8 million people had admitted to using OxyContin for non-medical purposes, which is abusing OxyContin.
Sure.
So you could argue that the horse was already out of the barn at that point.
Take me back for a second to West Virginia and that little town in way down in Virginia and the people surrounded by this epidemic.
Yeah, I mean, what struck me is that they remember those years in the late 90s and early 2000s really clearly. One of the people who we interviewed, a nun named Sister Beth Davies, she says that the town has never really recovered, and there are kids who are being raised by their grandparents because their parents are battling addiction. The marks of this epidemic are definitely still there.
I should say we've got a Purdue statement and also the FDA statement, right, on our website. Both of them declined interviews, as did various people at Purdue Pharma, yeah?
Yes.
Or formerly at,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Caitlin Esch reported this story for the podcast that she and Chrissy Clark at the Wealth and Poverty Desk work on. It's called The Uncertain Hour. It is out. This episode is out today. It is, I will tell you, extraordinary. Caitlin, thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up.
It's so much more satisfying because now you have so much information coming to you every minute of every day.
Satisfying for some, drowning in it for others, just saying. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 80 points today, about 0.3%, 24,585 for the blue chips. NASDAQ up 13 points, about 0.2%, 68.75. The S&P 500 dropped ever so slightly. We'll call it even 26.62. As we told you earlier, Ms. Yellen said, yes, Virginia, there is another interest rate hike, 0.25%. Banks took a slight hit today. Bank of America slipped about 1.6%. Citigroup lost 1.3%. J.P. Morgan Chase down about 1.25%. You know that facial recognition technology that's in the new iPhone X10? I don't know. What do you call it? Turns out not many places make the laser sensors needed for it, so Apple is buying Finisair Corporation, one of the fiber optics companies that do it, for $390 million. New manufacturing plant in Texas. Not a bad day for Finisar. Shares up 22%. Apple up 0.3%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Atlantic hurricane season this year was expensive. Estimates vary depending on what you measure and over what period of time, but we are talking up to $400 billion in damages between Harvey, Irma, and Maria. Here's one of the key challenges after the destructions that storms like that bring: where to live during the cleanup. FEMA helps pay for a place to stay while homes get rebuilt for some people, but what if there's just no temporary housing to come by where you are? That's the case in Rockport, Texas, which before Harvey had about 10,000 people living there. Marketplace's Andy Euler went to check in on their recovery.
These days, Angela Trevino, her two young kids, and her husband are living in their storm-damaged house, but they're confined to just the living room.
We had flooding. We have roof damage, which we have tarps on. The roof damage was inside as well because there is mold that is now starting to grow.
She knows that's a health risk. She applied for FEMA assistance to pay for a different place to live, but
I was not granted temporary housing, nor was I approved for that $400 through Red Cross as well, as many times that I've attempted to.
FEMA says Trevino should keep appealing, but she says she's done. And even if she was given money to get a hotel room or a short-term rental, there aren't many options in Rockport.
If you applied for FEMA, you know that when you called the number, they said, yeah, we can place you, but we're going to place you in San Antonio.
That's Trevino's boss, Kristen Barnaby, Rockport's district attorney. She says it's bad enough the DA's office had to move out of the flooded city hall and is now housed in an old motorcycle shop. She's not going to ask her staff to commute from San Antonio, more than 150 miles away.
And the practical reality, it's nobody's fault, it's just the practical reality of that is when they placed them in San Antonio, they were gone forever. They're not coming back.
Up to a third of the town's residents are now living elsewhere. Craig Griffin runs a restaurant in Rockport called Charlotte Plumbers. He says it's a constant struggle to keep staff.
When we first got started, I had 9 cooks. The storm hit. I came back, I had 5, so I'd lost 4 of them, and it was only because of no place to live.
When those cooks and workers like them move away, it shrinks the tax base. Rockport's mayor, C.J. Wack, says it's already eating into how he pays for police, fire, and waste collection.
If you have a place to put your workforce, then you have availability of people to assist the businesses that are reopening and then can contribute toward the economic recovery of the community.
Mayor Wax knows his town's recovery depends on temporary housing so people can rebuild permanent homes. County Judge Burt Mills says he doesn't expect people to pay taxes on houses that aren't there anymore.
If my house was gone, blown away this year, and I got a tax statement, I'd say, I'm not paying my tax. I don't have a house. What are you going to do?
But he says it's not just property and sales taxes. Rockport's a tourist town. Vacation rentals, fishing trips, weddings on the beach.
Our economy's in the toilet because our hotel-motel tax is gone. Our venue tax is gone.
It was taking so long to get temporary housing options into the area, the state brought in 30 prefab homes for FEMA to distribute to storm victims. That led to a new kind of housing solution, where FEMA owns the units, but a Texas agency is essentially the landlord.
This is the first of its kind for FEMA.
That's Robert Howard, a FEMA spokesperson. He says it used to be that FEMA staff would check in on things like updating each family's rebuilding progress or making sure the unit wasn't damaged. Now, the Texas General Land Office takes care of that.
This really is a state-administered, locally managed program. And, you know, we're just kind of the oil that's greasing that wheel to make that happen.
Residents in Rockport are thankful for any attempt at a housing solution, but many say these housing units should have been brought in months ago. Pete Phillips oversees the partnership at the Texas General Land Office.
I know it's frustrating for people because it's not happening yesterday, but to the greatest extent possible, we will speed up the process and continue, but we don't want to take shortcuts where people are impacted again.
Because Phillips knows if the state doesn't do this right, dot all the bureaucratic I's and cross all the T's, the General Land Office could wind up owing FEMA money. Or even worse, Texas residents could be handed a bill by the feds for their temporary housing. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Much has been made of the troubles that print journalism is having. Yes, newspapers in particular, also, though, magazines. So what do you do if you're a 100-year-old magazine company with titles that are doing pretty well, but you can read the handwriting on the internet, right? Media habits are changing, especially for those oh-so-lucrative younger sets of eyeballs. I'm talking to you about Condé Nast, publisher, among other things, of Vogue and Vanity Fair, a bunch more as well that you will know. 5 years ago, they created a new division, Condé Nast Entertainment, to figure out how to turn magazine content into digital and video content and whatever else, honestly, they could think of. Dawn Ostroff is president of Condé Nast Entertainment by way of traditional television. She used to run The CW, and she is also today's conversation from the corner office. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
We should say, just to start, you work for a big, giant magazine company, but you're a TV person from, like, and radio, actually, from way back.
Yes, I am. But, you know, these days, I think we're seeing everything merging and, you know, content migrating from platform to platform. So it seems like everybody is a little bit of everything these days.
It does indeed. Mm-hmm. So what do you do in Condé Nast and at Condé Nast Entertainment?
So Condé Nast Entertainment was a division that we started 5.5 years ago with the understanding that the landscape in the media space was really changing. And so I think they were very forward-thinking in looking at how they could start to expand the content that was being written. Mm-hmm. How do we take that onto other platforms? Now, in prior years, they had had many movies made based on some of the articles in the magazines.
Right.
But, you know, the company didn't necessarily participate in the creative process or in the financial.
Yeah, so it was the writer, right, who got the deal.
Yes, and
usually
the writer still does,
yeah.
But it's just as opposed to outside production companies making the movies or the TV
right.
shows, we're now involved in that whole process.
Right.
And in addition to that, digital video was starting to really come to fruition, and we knew that that would be an important part of the business going forward, which it has really turned out to be.
Right.
And so we also help oversee all the video content that the company makes.
The challenge, I guess, for you now is getting people's attention, right? So how do you, when you sit down with a project, how do you say, what do you do to say, listen, we need to get eyeballs on this? How do you do that?
It's interesting. We evaluate the content to understand what the best version of it would be and where it would lend itself on which platform. So, for example, when you're looking at something that's for television, oftentimes it's really about the characters and the relationship because people have to come back for maybe 7 years,
yeah, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
In the digital video side, we really create franchises, as we call them, from scratch.
Give me an example.
So we have a franchise called 73 Questions. We produce it for Vogue, and it's basically taking celebrities.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Been a while.
And
yeah.
while they are walking around their home,
yep.
our director is
yep.
asking them 73 questions.
Yep.
And so you feel like you know them a lot better than you would if you were just watching somebody else interviewing them. And so all of the content we make in video, which is a lot, we make about 5,000 videos a year. We'll do about 11 billion views this year, which is a
wow.
lot of people watching content. But everything we do is from a different perspective, understanding what the viewer's expectations are and speaking to them in a different way than you would if you were making a movie or you were making a TV show.
As you try to meet all those different viewer demands and you go cross-platform or you do whatever voodoo you do, my guess would be your advertising people go bananas because they're like, Dawn, we're trying to sell it here and now you're making us sell it here and how are we supposed to do this?
And you're right. It's very complex, but at the same time, the advertising community are the ones who are really pushing to meet to find the viewers. I mean, you have to realize that you have the advertising community who, by and large, has spent, you know, a lot of money on television for decades upon decades. And now they want to be where the consumer, where the viewer is. And particularly the younger Gen Z and millennials
mm-hmm.
are consuming now more than 3.5 hours per day on their mobile device. I mean, that's where they're watching video, more than 3.5 hours per day. That's an astounding number when you think about it. It's
mm-hmm.
the new prime time.
What are you reading? How do you stay on top of stuff?
Yeah, it's interesting. It used to be where you'd wait for all the magazines to be released and then
yeah.
just, you know, dive into a 2-hour read of Vanity Fair.
Those days are gone.
It's so much more satisfying because now you have so much information coming to you, you know, every minute of every day.
Do you not feel like you're drowning?
I feel like
asking for a
I'm
friend.
Drowning, but yet at the same time, I feel like the relevant pieces seem to rise to the top.
Huh.
At the same time, you know, that's why you need to have balance in your life. Family life, you know, hobbies, a little time off is really so important these days.
Dawn Ostroff, she is the president of Condé Nast Entertainment. Dawn, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
I vote for drowning, by the way. That was just a slice of my conversation with Dawn Ostroff. You can hear the rest of it, including her thoughts on whether we are in a digital video bubble on our Corner Office podcast. This final note on the way out today, a list for your movie downloading amusement. The National Film Registry, part of the Library of Congress, is out with its list of 2017 inductees. 25 films, the registry says, chosen for their cultural, historic, and/or aesthetic importance. Included? All right, here you go. Dumbo, La Bamba, Titanic, Spartacus. Also, Die Hard, which is, just for the record, is a Christmas movie. Don't fight me on that, y'all. It is a Christmas movie. The Dow up 80 points today, about 0.3%. NASDAQ up 13 points, 0.2%. S&P 500 basically flat on this last day that we hear from Janet Yellen. Probably. Who knows? Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.